Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, is the State of the Union anything other than preaching to the choir?
I will not allow the mistakes of recent decades past to define the course of our future. For too long, we've watched our middle class shrink as we've exported our jobs and wealth to foreign countries.
Donald Trump has now been president for a year, and so he'll report on the state of the American Union. Last year's address was a speech to a joint session of Congress. Karen Tumulty reports in the Washington Post that modern presidents have been giving these speeches in person since Woodrow Wilson tested it out in December of 1913. But let's be honest. These State of the Union speeches seem like a lot of back padding, posturing, and political theater. This year, the White House is saying the president will try harder to be more unifying. As our guests join us to talk about what that will mean and other themes that may come up in the speech, I'd like to hear from you. How does the state of our union as Americans feel to you? Are you celebrating low unemployment? Are you worried about income inequality? Are health care bills influencing your view of where we stand as Americans? I'd really like to hear your perception as President Trump gives his State of the Union speech. I think the way you perceive the State of the Union is every bit as important. So 651-227-6000 to tell me how the State of the Union feels to you economically, politically, culturally. 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, where I've been hearing from a lot of you this morning, it's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Reed Galen is with us. He's chief strategist of the Serve America movement, and he's with us today from Wichita, Kansas. Reed, welcome back to the show. Really good to have you here.
Thank you, Kerry. Thank you for having me this morning.
Lisa Garcia-Bedoya is with us. She's director of the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and with us today from Berkeley. And Lisa, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show, too.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Lisa, is it unusual that we have such a strong economy, and yet there seems to be a lot of anxiety and concern about the state of our union among average voters? Is that unique when you look back in presidential history?
I think definitely this administration can be seen as unique in the sense that the unpredictability of the president, I think that historically there's been, at least during the 20th century, since the early 20th century, there's been sort of a norm of behavior for presidents in terms of how they deal with the other party and how they make addresses in public and the degree to which, when they do make addresses in public, they follow through on the things that they say they want to do. And so I think what has happened with President Trump is that all those rules have kind of gone away. And so people pay much more attention to his every word because they know it can change. And so in that sense, the usual markers of what is a successful presidency don't seem to be quite as important because of that, the anxiety that arises from that uncertainty.
Okay, this is an interesting insight, Reed. Would you agree with that, that the way we would usually, the standards we would usually use to say, well, the State of the Union's pretty good. Look at what's happening with the economy. We're out of at least one war. Don't really apply.
No, I mean, normally, I mean, we have seen, even going back to someone like George H.W. Bush, who, remember, a year before his reelection was at 81% approval with the American voters. And by a year later, you know, he had increased taxes and a recession had hit, and he took the blame for both of those things. And so what I think we've seen with President Trump is that because of the way that he acts or his behavior or his words, we're sort of, maybe for the first time, at least in recent memory, seeing a decoupling from a president receiving, you know, support and approval for an economy that they likely have very little, if anything, to do with.
I was just going to ask you that, Reed. I mean, to be truthful here, much of this is President Obama's, as much as any president, right, has anything to do with what happens with the economy. Are voters taking that into stock, or is it, as you both have noted, everything else is such a distraction that the economy, I don't know, doesn't matter as much in the perception of where we're at politically?
I mean, I think that's right. I think from a national perspective, I think we're sort of psychologically tired, right? The president doesn't give us any days off. whether you are a supporter of his and he's keeping your, you know, the adrenaline pumping, or you don't agree with him and he is just sort of doing one thing after another that upsets you. I think that the other thing we should also remember is that it's taken 10 years for the American economy to climb out of where we were. You know, as far as the economic crash is concerned. So this is not exactly a quick turnaround. It's taken a decade for us to even get back to something considered, you know, moderate economic growth.
Do you think there's something to that, Lisa, that there is such a high state of anxiety coming out? And boy, the media totally contributes to this. But we live in this kind of state of high political anxiety. And so enjoying the gains, you know, as we might, of a good stock market and a good economy just don't apply because of all of this anxiety that swamps us.
I think that's true, but I also think it's important to note that the problem with the current economy, which was true under President Obama as well, is that its gains are not being distributed equally. And so many people have still not seen their wages increase significantly. They have been increasing, but at a very glacial pace. And so while it is true that the stock market is doing well, the fact of the matter is most Americans don't benefit from that unless they happen to have retirement investments or things of that sort. And so part of the issue is the trickle down to normal people and the degree to which the small amount of growth that we've had is actually affecting their day-to-day lives in terms of making their lives better. And at least thus far, it doesn't look like that is happening.
You know, Lisa, I wonder if the president's going to talk about that tonight. I mean, that is a key concern for the people that supported him and for the people who didn't.
Absolutely, and one would think he is going to talk about it. The problem is his economic plan and the tax reform that was passed at the end of last year doesn't do anything to alleviate that problem. And in fact, the regulatory changes he's made probably make it worse, both in terms of making it more difficult for workers to organize and also more difficult for them to be safe at work. And so this is part of the problem, is the disconnect between what Trump says on the populist side on issues like this and what his policies have actually been. And so the question is, can he still get his base to support him despite that contradiction?
Yeah, call here from Tom in River Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. How does the State of the Union look for you these days?
Well, I'm just in a little part of Wisconsin here over in River Falls, but I just wanted to mention that I'm a private music teacher, and I've seen my personal studio go from about 16 to about 26, 27, and I think that shows a reflection of my specific community getting better during the last year.
Things are looking better in your industry and actually in River Falls. So how does that influence the way you see the state of who we are as Americans, the state of the country today?
You know, I think that's a little bit of a complicated question for me. I don't know if I can say that I know. I just know that music lessons specifically is a bit of an extracurricular for a lot of families. And if they're able to go out and afford that, then I think families, at least in my community, are better financially because they're able to, I guess, afford my services.
A bit more of disposable income, right, reflected
yes.
in what you do. Thanks for the call, Tom. Reed, I want to go back to what Lisa said. She said, and I wonder if you think President Trump can take credit for whatever role deregulation and the tax cut that Congress enacted is having in this economy. She seemed to suggest that those are forces working against more equitable sharing of a good economy.
Well, I mean, I think if there's one thing we should always remember is that President Trump, and frankly, any president in the time of an economic upswing, is going to take credit for it, right? I mean, President Trump will probably be a little bit more ostentatious about it, but any president would take advantage of a rising economy and the credit that their actions and their policies and whatever legislative gains they might have made or legislative wins they might have had, that would be the reason for it. I think the other thing, you know, in addition to what we've been talking about, is also remember that although the economy is roaring, as Lisa said, remember that one in five American workers now is a contract worker, right? That's
right.
What they do full time. And
right.
So what we might be seeing is not only the income inequality, but if you are a contract worker, you're a 1099 worker, you are always on the edge of losing a client, losing work, perhaps losing, you know, health insurance coverage, which you're likely buying yourself. And so I think that's the other part, too, is that, you know, part of the tax cut program was also repealing of the individual mandate. Whether or not you like, you know, Obamacare, excuse me, the Affordable Care Act, it was a way for people to achieve health care that wasn't likely to break their bank. And so I think that there is an uncertainty that many Americans still feel, and I think is a hangover from the economic crisis, that we're always just afraid that we're one day away from, you know, everything, you know, toppling over again. I think, and it's likely to be with us for a while.
This is such a good point. I don't want to put too much emphasis on the gig economy. I know it's a factor, but as you said, it's one in five now. But that sense of my contract could end tomorrow, or I have no benefits, right? They don't provide health insurance and they don't provide a 401k. I can see why that would contribute to that anxiety that I was talking about a minute ago, Reed.
Yeah, and as your caller noted, right, he is a private music teacher. He went from 16 students to 26 students. That's incredible. But what would happen if the day comes where he goes from 26 students to 9?
Right.
You know, that is a significant reduction in his take-home pay. And I can't speak for him, obviously, but that would be a dramatic effect on his income and probably the way he would have to organize his life.
Nancy says on Twitter, I'm old enough to remember Reagan, Bush 1 and 2. Their actions often angered and frustrated me, but I never once feared that they'd try to destroy the foundation of our democracy like the current occupant of the White House is doing. I'm genuinely afraid for our country. Another listener here says, David, I work at the post office, economically great, politically divided. Lisa, we had a piece this morning on from Mara Liasson who talked about the tribalism in politics and how that leads us to demonize one another, the opposite tribe. Just in your research and your reading, what comes up for you around that?
Well, I do think it's important to note on the previous point about the gig economy. Sociologists talk about precarity instead of poverty, and I think that's an important way to think about it, that people, even if they're doing well, are kind of on the edge, that if one thing goes wrong, the house of cards is going to fall apart.
Precarity.
And I think that's a better way of thinking about why people are anxious. On the question of tribalism, actually, if you look at the research, it is true that activists in both parties have become more polarized. But the fact of the matter is most Americans are sort of in the middle, either, you know, in many cases not paying attention to politics or paying attention to it just a little bit, or in fact not in this dramatic sort of either-or space. But I think it's important not to have kind of that polarizing rhetoric blind us to the fact that what is true and related to what one of the listeners said is that this president is different in the sense of his willingness to really throw out basic norms of behavior and law that the president of both parties have followed. And so I don't think people's strong reactions to him is just because of a left or a right question. I think there are also some serious concerns about the degree to which his presidency is undermining our basic institutions.
I want to be clear, though, about what you were saying about this tribalism, because, you know, there's been a lot of writing and research on that. You're saying what? That is being exaggerated, that most Americans do not feel that strongly about aligning to one party or the other. This is really about Trump.
In fact, the fastest growing party identification in the United States is decline to state. So while it is true that Democrats and Republicans feel very strongly about Trump, and that's how we tend to report public opinion surveys, it's based upon people's party identification, the fact of the matter is about a third, if not more, depending upon which group you're talking about, of individuals actually don't identify with a party. They might lean one way or another, but they don't identify with a party, and we don't report on those folks. And so there is a tendency in the way we do polling and the way we do the reporting to overemphasize the partisan nature and not appreciate that there's a whole kind of middle in the United States that actually almost never gets paid attention to.
Reed, I'd love your insight on that.
Mm-hmm. No, I wholeheartedly agree with Lisa, and I think that it is both a design feature of our political duopoly and a huge bug for the American people, that the reason why you see so many polarizing figures elected to office is because of the way that we run our elections, the way that the parties organize themselves, that in primary elections, mostly activists show up. And so whether or not it's a Republican or a Democrat, by the time you get to November to the general election, most voters have two choices that they're really not pleased with, but they have no other options, right? And so, and then I think that the other part of that too is that, given, you know, whether or not it's the way that we draw our legislative districts, not necessarily in California, but in other places, you know, most of these legislative and U.S. House districts are not competitive at all. I think we have, you know, 10% of the congressional districts are considered, quote, competitive. Mm-hmm. A lot of voters just don't have the choices they would rather have that would give them an option other than the hard right or the hard left.
Reid Galen is with us this morning. He's a chief strategist of the Serve America movement with us today from Wichita, Kansas, and Lisa Garcia Bedoya with us from the University of California, Berkeley, where she's director of the Institute of Governmental Studies. We asked them to come in on this day when we're considering what President Trump will say about the State of the Union, and I'm asking you for your perception of the State of the Union. Not necessarily, yes, I'm hearing a lot about the president himself, but I'm also asking you, as you consider the state of who we are as Americans in this moment, that's really the question. How does this feel to you? Are you benefiting from the low unemployment? Are you part of that gig economy that we talked about? And so you're feeling this precarity, as Lisa put it. Are you worried about income inequality? Are healthcare bills and student loans influencing the way you see who we are and how we feel as Americans? So, yes, I know that you feel like this is an opportunity to vent about the president, but I'm also kind of taking your temperature on how we feel today about the state of the country and how we feel about one another. So give that some thought, too, if you will. 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR and to Fartoon in Minneapolis. Hey, good morning, and thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you for having me. I want to say a few things quickly. I'm hoping that the president tonight to talk about unifying and especially putting down the rhetoric about refugees and immigrants and Muslim communities that were creating problems and were taking. There are reasons a lot of people are unemployed that the immigrants and Muslim community are taking the resources. Immigrants are not taking money. They're actually putting a lot of money. That is a fact. So I'm hoping that he needs to put down his rhetoric down. And the other quick that I want a message that I send out to all of Americans, fellow Minnesotans, that we have to take responsibility and really slow down from the rhetoric and help one another. And finally, Minnesota's inequality of people of color mm-hmm. and immigrants needs to be dealt with. So I personally feel that no matter what, America had given me an opportunity and I'm going to fight for it. But we really need to come together and reduce this fear. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the call. A lot to talk about there, Lisa. First to what Fartoon said about the language that the president will use on immigration. I assume he's going to talk about it. He's been extremely divisive on immigration. What from every sense you have, is this a moment for him to signal maybe more of a unifying message on it? Or does it not matter because he may say one thing at the State of the Union and then tweet something else tomorrow night that's really divisive?
Well, both things are a problem. Even if his rhetoric is not as inflammatory as it has been, his policy positions, I doubt, are going to change. And so even if the words are nicer, the actual things that he's asking for are quite dramatic departures from how immigration has been dealt with in the United States, at least for the last 50 years. And then there's the secondary problem that even if he sounds quote-unquote presidential, whatever that means at this point in the speech, chances are he's going to undermine it, you know, within hours with some other comment. Because this is something very near and dear to it. This is one of the few policy areas I think he actually does have a position on. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes very unlikely for him to back down from what he's based his whole political career on.
Reid, I wonder if he really knows what he thinks about immigration. I hear Lisa saying this is one of the few policy areas where he has an actual position. Does he?
I mean, I would say this. I'm not sure that President Trump understands or necessarily even cares about the intricacies of immigration policy. But I think the one thing that he is very intuitively aware of is the fact that his base, that 30 to 35% of Americans who cheer and jump for joy when he takes that hard line. He is very attuned to how they feel about things. And so while his speechwriters may utilize different language for him tonight, it is going to be basically just get out your thesaurus, right? They're going to be synonyms of the same things he's talked about. My guess is also that he is going to try and pin Democrats down by saying, look, I'm all for making sure DACA kids get to stay here. Mm-hmm. But we also need to have common sense immigration enforcement at the border. He will say things like that. But to Lisa's point, you never know what's going to set him off. So he could be in the limo on the way back to the White House from the Capitol, see something he doesn't like on Twitter or on CNN, and just blow the roof off the whole thing.
Yeah, Lisa, yes?
Yes. Pretty much, yes. Well, and Steve Miller, by all accounts, is one of the main writers of tonight's speech, and he's vehemently anti-immigrant. So I don't see how this is going to be a softer, gentler Trump.
By the way, yesterday we talked about the fact that Miller and John Kelly and some of the other people that are in Trump's tight circle really want to limit legal immigration. Reid, I'm interested in what you think. Is he going to say something about that tonight? What do you think comes out on this immigration reform around legal immigration limits?
I think on legal immigration limits, I doubt you'll hear very much, because I think that there are even many Republicans, both in the United States Senate and in what we call the establishment wing of the Republican House, Speaker Ryan's wing, for mm-hmm. lack of a better way to put it, who are probably not very interested in discussing legal immigration or limits to it.
Really?
I think what you might hear more is, limits, I would say, different parameters for legal immigration, the lottery, more merit-based stuff. So if you're going to hear things about legal immigration, it won't be couched in the terms of limiting it, but, making sure that, quote, only the best people come here, which I think is divisive, which has the real ability to be divisive all by itself.
Absolutely. And Lisa, that's what it's all about, right? I mean, only the merit-based thing, as Reid says, only the best people end up coming in. But it is really about limiting legal immigration, isn't it?
Well, and especially only they can come and they cannot bring their family members. And so I do think they are going to talk about what they call chain migration. I disagree with that framing. Your family reunification has been the cornerstone of American immigration policy for decades, based on the humane point that if you come, you actually should be able to have the people you love with you. So that I do believe they are going to talk about. I think that it is about reducing legal immigration, even if they don't say it explicitly. And I also think it's important to note how much, while it is true that many Republicans in the establishment aren't supportive of Trump's policies, the center has shifted pretty dramatically to the right mm-hmm. among Republicans, and the conversation has shifted pretty dramatically. And I just want to be sure that we note that significant change that has happened within a fairly short period of time.
We talked about that yesterday. Yeah. Sonia says on Twitter, precarity. Most millennials I know have side hustles because with student loans and health care, they can't afford to live with just a full-time job. To the phones to Jordan in Excelsior. Hi, Jordan. You're a recent college grad. Is that right?
Hi. Yeah, I am, actually.
How does the state of the union and the economy feel to you?
So for me, it's just, I mean, even just through college, it became more aware to me that, finding a job post-graduation would be a lot harder, especially my degree in political science. So there's a lot more limitations with that. And right now, I mean, just being out of college a few years, I'm not anywhere near what my undergraduate degree was. I just had to kind of follow where I could actually make a living. And I think with that I'm not in the minority with that. And I think that opens another question is with more people who are opting not to go to school and invest in education. I'm just curious kind of where that will lead us to, because me, myself, I have a $3,000 in debt, and I would not put that in my children or people that I care about to be where I'm at right now.
Your phone cut out. You have $50,000 in student loan debt?
Yep.
Okay. Lisa, give our young political scientists some hope here.
Oh, as a political scientist, I feel very bad. I mean, I don't think her story is unique. I think the fact of the matter is this is part of why many young people are ending up moving back home with their parents after college. I think it's difficult, again, because of those structural changes in the economy, to find something that feels like a career and that feels like it gives you the status. And in particular, here in the Bay Area, it's exacerbated by the just dramatic cost of living where we are. So for some people, in the tech sector and other places, they're fine. For others who don't manage to find that great job, it's actually quite difficult. And we have to remember that she's one of the lucky ones. College-educated people are much more likely to be employed and employed well in our economy. If you have only a high school degree or less than a high school degree, your ability to have a living wage is really compromised in this current economy.
Reed, what do you want to bet $5 that the president doesn't mention student loan debt, which used to be on the minds of a lot of politicians, and now it seems to have dropped off the table? I don't know why. It's still a big deal for a lot of young Americans, but I bet it doesn't come up.
No, I can almost assure you that it will not come up, but I think there's a couple of things for that. One is that, I mean, you know, I can't speak for you or Lisa, but when I was in college, right, that was 20 years ago. That was still the tail end of an American economy roaring since the end of the Second World War.
Yep.
It is a different world now. It is a different world for why you'd go to college, what it is you're going to get out of college, and what's going to happen when you're out of college. I think also, you know, the student loan debt thing is also one that I think is important for folks who are trying to go to college, as Lisa said, to try and find that career path. But I think also remember, too, that there are many, many jobs, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs in this country that are good paying jobs that do not require a college degree. And so what I think you're going to see, the reason why you wouldn't see either, from a purely political point of view, you might not hear President Trump talk about that, A, because it's just not on his list of things to do, but B, because I think that in a lot of the places where President Trump has been very successful, you're spending a lot of time talking about student debt to people who, A, never had the ability, or B, the opportunity to go to college, is sort of talking right past them.
Okay, wait, so let me make sure I understand that. You're saying that in a lot of the areas where his base is, this opportunity to go to college is not what high on their list of options.
I don't want to say it's on their high on their list of options. I would say it's probably not high on their list of opportunities.
Okay.
And if you live in the Bay Area, or if you live in a suburban area, urban area, you know, the idea that you can go to college, community college, while it may not be everybody's first choice, is usually an exceptionally good deal on your way to a 4-year degree. But if you live in the hollows of Kentucky and you are trying to figure out how you're going to, when you wake up tomorrow, how you're going to pay the light bill, you might dream of sending your child to college, but that might not be a reality for you.
But Reed, on the other hand, when I look at the income spectrum of the people that supported President Trump in the 2016 election, he had a lot of Americans who were in middle income areas. I mean, those are people who aspire to send their kids to college and hope to try to help. It isn't all. Go ahead.
No, I don't disagree with you. But also remember that I think that it would be interesting to see, while I don't disagree with you, it would also be interesting to see how many of those people, if had the choice today to vote for Donald Trump again, A, would do it, and B, if had had an option other than Hillary Clinton, would have taken it.
Mm-hmm. Lisa,
I think that what you're seeing now, especially in, places where we saw, suburban Republican women in places like Alabama,
for sure,
in the special election there, who might have voted for Donald Trump in November 2016 because they just, for whatever reason, couldn't abide Secretary Clinton, might not ever come back to him.
Lisa, what do you think?
I think that's true, but I think your point is an important one, which is that Trump supporters are middle income, but they tend to not have a college education. So both of you are right in the sense that, yes, they are not necessarily the poorest of the poor. In fact, most of those folks supported Clinton. But they are the people like firefighters, police officers, people who it used to be without a college education could have a middle-class life and who feel like that life has not has been undermined or is not as secure as it used to be. But I think the more important point about college loans and college in general is that over the last 20 years, part of the shift has been this idea that college is an individual good, right? Mm-hmm. That it's just for the elite or it's just for that person. And so that's part of why there's been this dramatic shift away from grants to loans, right? Part of the reason we expect people to pay for it is this idea that individuals should be able to pay for it and that we have simultaneously disinvested in state public higher education. I will admit to be self-interested here. I teach at Berkeley. But when I started at Berkeley, I was an undergrad at Berkeley. I started in 1987. It was $1,200 a year to go to that school.
Mm-hmm.
It is now about $13,000.
Wow.
Right? There's been a dramatic change in how much it costs, and it reflects our society's sense that that's not an investment we should make as a collective, that each student should basically pay for it and carry that weight on their own. And I think that is a very bad idea, and I think it, in the long term, it's going to hurt us.
And Karen, can I just step in there?
Please.
Yeah, I mean, I attended the University of Texas at Austin, so like Berkeley is California's flagship. You know, UT Austin is Texas's flagship, and I would say that is absolutely, I think, a terrific point, which is there was a time. Look, when I went to UT, it was $2,000 a semester to go to state school, to go to the flagship university of the second largest state in the country. Mm-hmm. It's now, I think, above probably $10,000 or $12,000. And that's exactly right. The opportunity to go to college to get a first-class, world-class education, you know, that was sponsored by the state because the state understood that that was a good thing for its population,
right.
has now become out of reach for far too many people. And I think that is really a shame and one that we should spend more time on.
This is really interesting because Minnesota went through this too. And you know how we value higher education in this state. And yet there was a pulling back with tight budgets at the state of supporting are what we call land-grant universities here.
Mm-hmm.
And yet no one ever articulated this idea of, are we now saying that it is not in all of our interest, the common good, to higher educate as many Minnesotans as we can, that really you're going to benefit, so this is on you. Do I have that right, Lisa? That's kind of the choice and the philosophy?
Absolutely. And to appreciate that the engines of growth in our current economy are actually surrounding, you know, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson did a really nice analysis of this, that if you look at the areas surrounding universities, in fact, those are the places that are growing most dramatically in red states and blue states. It doesn't matter, because what matters in the current world is intellectual property, right? Is ideas, is technology, is advances in all areas of science and whatnot. And so it's a very short-sighted decision, and it's one that I think there hasn't been enough conversation about, because it really does then burden the individual students, especially, and it exacerbates inequality, because the ability to carry that debt load is going to be very different if you have a family that's got, you know, that has a nice safety net versus a family that doesn't. But additionally, as a society, it means we're not investing in the future in the way that we should, and the gains from, you know, those investments are exponentially greater than the cost.
Lisa Garcia Bedoya with us from the University of California, Berkeley, and Reid Galen with us from the Serve America movement. As we talk about what is and is not going to turn up in the State of the Union speech tonight, I'm asking you how the state of the economy feels to you. And we've had some people talking about student loans. And so we discussed an overriding philosophy that seems to be influencing the way we fund higher education. Also want to hear from you about if the economy feels good to you, how does it feel politically and culturally in this moment? Right now, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And we're listening back to some of President Trump's other speeches. This is his first State of the Union. Here's an excerpt from President Trump's inaugural address in 2017.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
You remember that as kind of a dark speech. We're talking about some of the things that President Trump will say, how that will be heard by American voters, and talking about some of the themes that he'll develop. Reid Galen with us from the Serve America movement, and Lisa Garcia Bedoya with us from the University of California, Berkeley. I'll grab a call here from John in St. Paul. John, thanks so much for waiting. I'm glad you did. What are you thinking about here?
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I am I would say a middle class American. I'm 40 or so years old, and I represent a lot of people. I have a young daughter, and I'm more concerned about her future because I feel like I've always been employed. Economy is good. I'll always have a job, but I think with the upcoming State of the Union address that what we really need to hear is what's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, if you're going to talk about the State of the Union, what about the future? I think, unfortunately, we might have a couple sound bites. We're going to hear about the economy. We're going to hear about the wall. Everybody's going to cheer. But why don't we talk about the international, the dissolution of international ties, or the failure to disclose, finances, or you know, we're not going to hear about any of the things that we probably should. But I think that at the end of the day, we really need to hear about what's going to happen to the future of, you know, what Lisa and Reed were saying about the future of education. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, is there an alternative, especially with the current news about Amazon and
with the healthcare partnership.
With healthcare, I mean, can we do that? Can we do that for education? Is somebody going to step up in the corporate sector that's going to represent, you know, the future of our children? And will that be in tie with what Trump wants?
You know, this is a good point. And I wonder, Lisa, if that's what State of the Unions are, or are those the ideas that our caller is bringing up, are those usually policy speeches, which sometimes don't get as much attention as they should?
Right. I mean, I think often it's both. I mean, the State of the Union usually is where the president both tries to take credit for all the good things that are happening, tries to distance themselves from all the bad things that are happening, and then tries to lay out some sort of vision for the kind of America that they want to see or that they're trying to build. And there usually are, you know, Clinton, I think, was the most policy wonky in this regard, but there usually are some policy proposals talked about, not in tremendous detail, but it is part of this broader vision. And I agree with the caller that also as a parent, I think thinking about the vision, I think the vision is very much about the here and now, but it's difficult to see how the current administration's positions on climate change, the movement towards aggression with North Korea, and many other of the things going on as a result of the Trump administration, how that makes us both safer and more prosperous in the future. And so he probably will talk about that in general terms, but I don't think that Trump really has that sort of vision other than to say that by hunkering down and circling the wagons, we're going to all be better off.
Right. I mean, Reed, we hear John saying, I want to know what kind of a world my daughter is going to grow up in. Well, a lot of that is unpredictable. I guess that's kind of the nature of the world we live in. But do our presidents, any of them, very good at really articulating that?
Well, some are better than others, but I think that, you know, we are by nature and unfortunately, you know, a society dominated by short-termism. We want something and we want it now. I mean, you know, you can order a refrigerator from Amazon and it'll show up on your doorstep tomorrow.
I know, right? Isn't that great?
I mean, it's great in many ways, but it also sort of distorts our conception of what it means, A, for government to do something, B, what is it government supposed to do, and C, how is that going to happen and when's it going to happen? Who's going to pay for it? All the other things. So to Lisa's point, yeah, I mean, traditionally while the State of the Union, a State of the Union address or message is in the Constitution, these have typically become this is the menu by which the president, you know, whoever the president is going to lay out their legislative and policy agendas for the coming year. Or for, you know, depending on where they are for the remainder of their term or their presidency, whatever. And then they go off and they basically do a roadshow. They go to Iowa to discuss manufacturing and they go to California to discuss education, wherever it is. President's not going to do anything. And I think also just stylistically, that clip you played from President Trump in Davos, that's how he's going to sound tonight.
Is it?
And I think that's the one thing. When he is locked into a teleprompter, he is not himself. And so it'll be interesting to see those times when he can't control himself, when the steam slips out from the tea kettle to ad lib. That will be very telling, too, because you can tell he looks like he's speaking from a straitjacket when he talks
it's
into that
true.
Teleprompter.
So true. Lisa, I like the fact that John brought up healthcare, this thing with Berkshire Hathaway and Amazon that I think The Times is reporting on today. Will there be talk of healthcare, or does this seem like, even though this is a big deal in a lot of Americans' lives, does it seem like so yesterday for Congress?
I think Trump just wants to take as much credit as humanly possible. I think that's his personality. So I think he will mention health care in the sense that he got the win in the tax bill in terms of the health care taxes.
Yeah.
So I think he'll mention that. But in terms of actually dealing with the problem and providing health care, no, I don't think he's going to talk about it, A, because it's not a win, and then B, because I'm not really sure he cares that much about it. I think what he wanted to do was get rid of Obamacare, addressing the real problems that are going on with the health exchanges and the system in general right now. I'm not sure that's something that he wants to focus on at all.
Yeah. Call here from Liam in St. Paul. Liam, you sound like you have an interesting background. What's the story?
Hi, yes. So I am a securities trader. I'm still in high school. I trade stocks and the U.S. Stock Exchange. But one of the things that I notice a lot in this economy is that the president and the administration is touting for, you know, the big growth in the economy and, you know, the jobs and all the things that are being made. I don't necessarily see it that way. I see very big gains for investors and people who are in the market, but really for a lot of other people in the economy, you know, people still in college, high school students even, who are looking for jobs, the economy is not doing so great for them because there's no growth in, you know, where they need it to be.
So because you're in the market, you're seeing these kinds of gains, but a lot of your friends and your student friends are not, and their families aren't experiencing this.
Yeah, I mean, even my teachers, I'll say, they're not really experiencing much growth or, you know, income growth through this.
Yeah. You're planning to go to college, I assume, yes?
Yes, UMD, actually.
To the University of Minnesota Duluth. So, how about paying for that? Is that something that your family is talking about, concerned about?
No, I'll be paying for that.
Because of your securities trading?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Impressive. Glad you called. Lisa, I actually think that you were saying earlier what Liam has brought up again, which is this idea that if you're not in the market, this doesn't feel so good to you.
Yes. I mean, the fact that the benefits are not distributed equally across people who are participating in the U.S. economy, and that's been a problem for a long time. It's only probably going to accelerate given the changes in tax policy that happened last year and in the gigitization, I don't know if that's a word, but the increase in the gig economy,
yeah.
Again, that makes it so that even if you're making a decent income, that's why I like the precarity idea, you know that you're just one calamity away from having something major go wrong, and people aren't able to save, and they're not able to feel that sense of security. And imagining retirement is insane, right? It's not something most people can do, or most people have the ability to save what's necessary to make that security possible. And so I think that structural change in the American economy is one of the things that's underlying what happened in the 2016 election, and none of the policies that have been proposed by this president are going to make that better. In fact, all of those tendencies have just accelerated over the last few years.
Reid, I'm not sure the Obama administration had a handle on this either. I mean, I remember doing a lot of shows about and who's going to help and what policies really make a difference, and there didn't seem to be much help coming from them either.
No, and, you know, I think a couple of things. One is that, you know, there, if you think about probably up until the 1980s, maybe, the early 90s, you know, people went to work and they might have had that job for 20 or 25 years. And there was health care and there was a pension. And so, you know, you could count on that. And companies saw that as sort of, you know, that's part of what you get for working here, right? Whether it was GM or GE or whoever it was.
Yeah.
You know, the social contract between, you know, American citizens, American workers, and their employers has drastically changed. The type of work has drastically changed. The type of education needed for that work has drastically changed. And we're still lining kids up, you know, in elementary school classrooms like they're going to go on an assembly line someday. I mean, it's just – so we're just decades behind on that stuff. I would also say – you know, vis-a-vis the tax cuts and everything else, you know, one thing I think that has been and is still part of Republican orthodoxy is that for some reason, you know, trickle-down economics is still part of, you know, the ethos of, you know, lower taxes will increase economic growth.
Right.
But that's probably marginally true. That's probably marginal.
As in there's no real economic research to show that, to support it.
Right. And I would say that, you know, when people talk about what happened with Reagan and the tax cuts of 81, remember back then, A, it was a completely different economy, and B, the top marginal tax rate was 70%. So you slash that in half, suddenly there was money just awash in the economy that hadn't been there before. Now what you see is if the 1% are the wealthiest, they're going to plow that money back into stocks. Companies are going to buy back their stock to goose their stock price, to, you know, give dividends back to those same people who don't already need the money. And
So
what's happening is that the money doesn't trickle down. It just stays up in the clouds.
But that's really good perspective. I forgot that the top tax rate, or I guess I didn't know this, was at 70% during the Reagan administration. Wow. Yeah, it's a lot of Americans feeling like they had more money.
Right. Yeah, and had been as high as 90% when Eisenhower was president.
Wow.
So that was, you know, it was just a much different thing.
Yeah. Call here from Jim in St. Louis Park. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, well, you know, as far as what you just said, I thought the big difference between this last tax bill revision thing was that the individual rates really didn't change too much as far as the rich people goes. and that the big break was for the corporations. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's not the same trickle-down situation as it was under Reagan. But that's as far as I know it. I think Trump's great. You know, my wife and I just bought a new car. The down payment was entirely paid for with our profits from our 401k plan. Mm. And I just don't get all this negativity against him. I think that's the other thing I like about him is his bringing to light some of this media bias and collusion and coordination with these media corporations. I hope what it leads to is a bust up of their monopolies, like Teddy Roosevelt did with the banks and the trusts or whatever it was. That's my two cents there.
Yeah.
Folks.
So Jim, the economy's feeling pretty good to you at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
And that young man who called, I think he's wrong because the unemployment amongst blacks is at its all-time low. Like, they've never recorded it lower, apparently.
It's good that you brought that up. Lisa, I think we do need some, because the president has been talking about this, right? Unemployment among African-American Americans has hit a low, but it is, we have to note, still close to double what it is unemployment for white Americans. Do I have the numbers right?
You do have the numbers right. And the very important thing is to look not just at employment, but wealth. And if you look at, and so what happened in the economic crisis, especially for Latinos, because most of their wealth was in their homes, you had a dramatic collapse of wealth within communities of color, partly because there wasn't as much wealth in there in the first place because they weren't able to take advantage of things like federal home loans and all those things that were redlined and not available to African Americans and to other groups of color. And so the wealth gap between whites and communities of color is dramatic. It's in you know 20 times and 30 times. It's not even the double that we're talking about. So again, this is the precarity question. If you don't have members of your family who are okay, right, or who can provide a safety net to you, then it doesn't matter how much income you make because you know that you're the safety net for all those other people who aren't able to have that economic security. And so it's a lot more complicated than whether you have a job, and it's really the product of decades and centuries, in fact, of history of not giving opportunities to African Americans especially that now is reflected in the lack of wealth and the lack of that sort of economic safety net within those communities.
Lisa, so glad you brought your perspective and your insight and your knowledge to the conversation. Thank you. Good to have you.
Thank you so
Come
much
back
for having me.
Anytime. And Reed, I have one last thing to read to you. This was in The Atlantic yesterday. It was an editorial by Elliot Cohen from Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And he's writing about the people that are still supporting the president. There remain thoughtful individuals who think of Trump as a vulgarian, but cannot bring themselves to turn on him. To adhere to that position, they have to believe two things, that words don't matter and character doesn't matter. How would you assess that argument?
Well, as an erstwhile Republican, I would say I was already on my way out of the party before President Trump, but certainly his ascendance accelerated that process. I think it's true, but I think that, you know, look, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, the tribalism piece is very difficult. And if you believe that what the president is doing vis-a-vis policy is the right thing, but you dislike how he says it, mm-hmm. you might be willing to live with that. Is that something I'm willing to live with? I'm not.
So when you're headed out of the Republican Party, where are you going to?
Hopefully better and brighter places politically. So I think there's, Lisa's earlier point, you know, there are a third of people who consider themselves unaffiliated or independent. And
yeah.
I think there's a lot of movements. I've worked with a lot of different people, including the Serve America movement, who are, you know, actively and rapidly trying to organize those folks to give all of us more and better choices.
Wow. Really good to have you on the show, as always. Thanks so much for
Thanks
the time.
You.
Reed Galen with us from the Serve America movement and Lisa Garcia Bedoya with us from the University of California, Berkeley. One last point here, because once we started talking about student loan debt, the Twitter really lit up again. A listener says, I'm a Gen Xer. When I graduated years ago, an Irish friend of mine noted that we indenture our young people with schooling debt. He was urging me to write a book at the time. I said I needed a steady job because of loans. It's only worse now. If you missed part of the conversation, find it on my podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen.